And thanks for joining us now on KVCR for KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. On this edition of the program, more of my conversation with Michelle Dowd, author of Forager, Field Notes for Surviving a Family Cult, a memoir. Michelle grew up in a very isolated cult started by her grandfather, who was seen as the last prophet and who would lead the organization after they, the righteous, survived the apocalypse. Michelle, of the various evangelical and money-raising trips you went on, there was a time when you noted that your little brother, 3 years old at the time, fell asleep, and your grandfather woke him by kicking him in the head. You said at this point that you knew that while your grandfather was a prophet, he would never be your God.
I saw my grandfather as very cruel. Okay. My grandfather was not kind to me or the people that mattered to me. I'm not saying he wasn't kind to anyone. I think he did probably have a great deal of loyalty to my mother, but he was not kind to my father. He was not kind to the boys that I particularly was drawn to. And so when I witnessed that, including my brother getting kicked in the head, but other things around that time, I knew that I didn't like him. To be fair, I was also raised with the God of the Old Testament, which the God of the Old Testament is jealous.
Yep.
The jealous, God of wrathful. Angry, yes, wrathful.
Yeah, the King James version of that. So
yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. So it was not a conflict to say that my grandfather was a prophet and he was angry
yeah.
and
okay,
wrathful and vengeful and jealous and all those things. And so he was not my God because I didn't want to worship that particular God. But I would say that he was synonymous with the God of the Old Testament to me. And I questioned that probably from about the age of 8, is why are we worshiping this God that none of us would want to be? And it felt, too, without me understanding the language of it, that it was a very male God. And there became this, you know, movement of this question, which I think took place in the outside world, too, was what would Jesus do? You know, I think some people wore those bracelets like WWJD or something.
Yeah.
And I remember being very young, maybe 11 or 12, and, you know, I had started menstruating, and I thought, Jesus never had a period. What would Jesus do? Jesus wouldn't do this. And I felt, I didn't say it out loud, but I felt very much like there was a very gendered God. There was really no place for women in the religion of the patriarchy. And patriarchy, I didn't see it as a political thing. I saw it as the he begats. It means like only men mattered in the line of Christ.
You know, there was something that was really cool that happened once. You talk about your dad being a very capable person. You also speak of him being a guy straight out of the army, and that's kind of how he treated people and things. You spoke about him being a very capable person, and that is to say someone meant to be on the mountain, someone who could do things. I mean, he could crawl under a car, crawl onto a house and fix and do whatever. Girls, though, were not entirely capable. And one day, though, you did something that men did, because it was what your dad was doing. And I'm talking about shaving. Shaving your face.
Mm-hmm. With a fake blade, but yes.
You took the blade out before handing it to you, but then you scraping it off to reveal the soft skin underneath, it left you with a feeling of accomplishment, and you were doing something that one of these strong men could do. Look, maybe I can stand this way as well.
Mm-hmm. I felt that my dad respected me when he saw me do that. And I felt like the motions of masculinity was enough for my father. And that literally happened. But as I got older, my father, if I was around, couldn't help but treat me like a man or a boy who was turning into a man. And so there was a lot of things my dad taught me, like shaving, that were inappropriate for a girl. But if there was no one else around, he just had me do them. So we were, you know, carrying logs or doing whatever. But he also said to me more than once, but he basically had, I feel like my mom had two instructions and my dad had two instructions. My dad told me to never count on a man. That was one of his big phrases. And then he also taught me to always have a trade, always be good with your hands, because then you'll always be valuable. For example, my father, he was raised very, very poor, and his mom had an eighth grade education. He was an only child. He did not have a father himself. And so when he came to this organization when he was 12 and was raised by a man who would later be his father-in-law, he was really good with things with his hands. He was very athletic, a lot of things like that. And he was useful in the organization for that reason. And my grandfather chose him as his right-hand man because he could plow the fields. He could fix the vehicles. He could drive the vehicles. My father was the driver on every single trip for 60 years across the country over and over. He can tell you to this day where every road goes, every single thing in every city. He can tell you where you can find a bathroom. He knows everything about this country because he's done it over and over and over on the roads. And he is a very capable man. He was always capable. So he taught me, which is not really relevant anymore, but at the time, my way around an engine. He thought that, learning to change the oil was absolutely necessary for every human being who ever got near a car. You should be able to change a tire, you know. And so I was doing all those things as a young girl. And it's nice to be capable.
Oh, sure.
I've met a lot of women who had learned helplessness. Like someone taught them that they would get attention for being helpless. And in retrospect, I think I'm very fortunate that I was taught the opposite.
No, absolutely. Growing up, did any of the kids have that secret radio or secret romance novel? You know, somebody had snuck in where everybody's reading the Bible during the day, but at night by candlelight, you're seeing Fabio with his, you know. There had to have been other kids who perhaps didn't have this complete, absolute, unwavering faith enough to sneak a glimpse of the outside world.
I don't think anyone was able to pull that off on a trip because every single belonging you had was monitored.
Oh, I see.
You all had to pack exactly the same items in exactly the same format. You had the exact bin in the bus. You didn't have suitcases. You didn't have bags. Everything was transparent, so everything was out. So I never saw anybody sneak anything because I just don't know how they would have got a hold of it. Also, no one was allowed to have any money.
Nobody could
purchase anything. Now, later, when we would be on the mountain, I do, in retrospect, remember a girl. But by this time, I was 16. A teenage girl did sneak. It was a romance book. It was completely clean. I think it was a Christian romance, but I did get a hold of that. And that was super interesting to me. There was no sex in that book, but it was a form of a romance book. And that's the only time I saw someone sneak that. I did get a chance when I was alone on the mountain to listen to the radio a little, and I would dial in, and I did hear a little bit of popular music.
Okay.
So definitely. And my sister had a CB radio. She did know Morse code, and we were taught to communicate like that. But she didn't seem interested in the outside world in that way. Like, she was scared of it. It's remarkable when you have a very small, like, there would be on these trips maybe, depending on the year, 55 to 70 members on this trip.
But
you can keep very close tabs on 55, 60 people if you have a lot of rules. It's pretty easy to see into the inner recesses of every single person's. We all wear the exact same clothes, for example.
Oh, that's right. I remember reading that that was to make yourself stand out from the other people, but I never took it as a way of them keeping track of you. That's an interesting reason for separation.
Yes, you can definitely keep track of people if they're all dressed the same, and you can know exactly where they have their pockets. I wore a jellaba. They're kind of large hooded robes. They have a zipper up front. They go all the way up to your neck, and they have hoods to cover your hair. It's not a burqa, but it's a little bit like that.
Okay.
And it covers your hands, long sleeves, and it goes down to your ankles. And so when we would be in the campground, we would wear the jellaba so that our bodies were formless and completely covered. But in retrospect, it also made us pariahs.
Because
and so the only kind of question they would ask us maybe is, who are you or whatever? It definitely set us apart. And so no one wanted to be our friends.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Wow. We alluded to this earlier. I want to talk about the incident with your mom playing piano. One day as you were walking back to the house, you heard music. You got inside and, I mean, one, you didn't even, I didn't know we had a piano. You said that, I remember. And then you got inside and there was your mother playing, it was a Mozart sonata or something to that effect. And when you got in the house, she just closed the piano and denied being able to play. I mean, ever learning anything about music. You asked her directly and you had seen her playing and you had heard her playing. You were a direct witness, but she would always, you know, I heard you playing. No, you did not. What was that beautiful music? You didn't hear anything. I didn't know you could play. I don't. Were you ever able to get an answer out of her or just ever reason it out? Well, let's start with that. Were you ever able to get a...
When it came to piano, I was. At the time, I didn't understand this. She had a lot of shame around her inability to play at the level that her mother did.
Oh.
So her mother supported the family on her piano playing and on her teaching of piano. So my grandmother married a man who's starting a cult, and I think he married her because she could play the piano, and so she could bring music into kind of creating this mystique. You know, they got married in the 1930s. They started having children even in the 1930s. There were three sons born before my mother was born in the 1940s. And my grandmother was a musician, and she, I think, wanted her daughter to learn how to play. And her daughter didn't learn how to play because her father didn't want her to play. There was all this tension around it. She wasn't supposed to know how to play. She then felt that it was wrong that she knew this. So it was her own secret. And I think as my mom got older, and I witnessed my mom. My mom was 79 when she died, and she still had so much shame around all of this. And she finally got to the point, I think, not that she ever confessed anything, but that I understood a little bit where that came from. So my mother wanted very much to be like her father, not like her mother. She wanted to be dutiful and godly, and she saw her mother as weak. Which is so interesting because my grandmother supported everybody. She earned all the money. She's the one who like held the family together. She gave birth to five children. She raised five children while she was earning a living. And my mother never respected that because she felt that her mother was just a woman. And being a woman was something to be ashamed of. And she saw playing music as being very feminine. Now, my mother was also a gaslighter, of course, but that's because my mother needed to believe what the party line was. And she needed to keep the party line, otherwise she would have chaos on her hands.
Okay, there we go.
Not justifying her choices, but explaining them in a context that would make sense to her.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Find many past shows through iTunes, Spotify, NPR One, and Google Play, and more still at kvcrnews.org/arts. On this edition of the program, I'm speaking with Michelle Dowd, author of Forager, Field Notes for Surviving a Family Cult, a memoir. This is a cult which was started by her grandfather, seen as a prophet who would live to the age of 500. More at michelledowd.org, also on Instagram, michelledowdz, also mdowd.substack.com. The book is available in hardback, paperback, Kindle, and audio anywhere books are sold, and all are on Amazon. We'll have these links again at the end of the program. When your grandfather died, this had to have changed so much, not just for you, but for the community as well. Now, one small example of this, there was a gathering of people. The thing is I remember you noticing some of the women wearing jewelry. Clip-on earrings at the very least, which, because of this, your grandfather would have called them harlots or Jezebels if he had seen this. What other changes in the community do you recall seeing? I would imagine with him passing, there would have been some of the strictness had to have passed on as well, and some of the, well, I mean, again, people were looking at him like the last prophet, and as far as anybody knew, he was going to live to 500.
So I think there was about a two-week period where everyone was just holding their breath, waiting, and it really didn't matter to move forward because clearly he was coming back. There was going to be trumpet. There was going to be lightning. We were just waiting.
He wasn't gone.
He wasn't. He was going to resurrect.
Okay.
And then when he didn't resurrect, there were some power struggles, I think, to see who would be taking over. And there was a lot of fear. And they decided to move the organization forward because God has a plan that they weren't aware of or whatever. So they started to ask God and pray a lot and sit together. And they had something called a corporation. And they would sit and they would try to make decisions. And so, interestingly, the organization became even more strict very, very soon thereafter. I would say within a month, they cracked down on everything. And then they purged out anybody who wasn't a believer and started over with the people who were willing to be much more hardcore. And so that is somewhat why my teenage years were particularly harsh, is because they needed to prove that they were still following God and that they were doing the right thing. And they didn't have a charismatic leader to do that. They had somebody who took over, and my mom was one of the big people who took over. They had to live according to their understanding, since he never wrote anything down. I'm not even sure my grandfather could write. He never wrote anything in his lifetime. And so they had to go on memory. And of course, memory is unreliable, including my own. But they had to try to uphold his standards. And until my mom died, she 100% said that she spent her life as a devoted follower of her father. And she never once questioned, up until her death, anything that he had ever said or done. And she thought that I was a horrible human being for not keeping the faith.
Going back to when you were much younger, I suppose we're maybe backing up 5 to 7 years here, you were severely ill for, there was, I suppose, a period of maybe about 3 years, 9 to 12, 10 to 13, somewhere in there where you were in and out of the hospital a lot. But it was an autoimmune deficiency, and you learned the word because it was a neat word to say.
Idiopathic thrombocytopenia purpura.
That's easy for you to say. Did being in the hospital, did this give you a glimpse at the secular world? Well, of course it did, because I know that that's where, for example, you read some of the great brain books, for example, way back when. But yeah. Did you find the joy in that? As in, whoa, this is what's out there?
I think I was afraid to feel joy, but okay. I did have access to a hospital library. They basically brought the books in. There was not a physical space that was a library. They probably had things stored, but they'd ask you what they want and they would get it for you. And so that really increased my reading, although, of course, I had to hide that. I must have experienced some joy. I experienced wonder. There was a television in the hospital, so I didn't control the television. There wasn't even a remote control, I don't think. Hospitals are interesting spaces, though, because they are also outside of the regular world. Yeah. Like, there are parts of the secular world in there, but they're very isolated and protected spaces, especially a children's hospital. All patients have to be under 18. So you're looking at an environment that's already a little bit sanitized because it's not adults.
Yeah, true. And you don't really, the only access to adults you would have had would have been doctors, nurses. I mean, there's not really... It's not like you were suddenly getting that prisoner passing you the secret newspaper or anything like that. It was
right. And most of the children who were in there were very ill because we were all inpatients. And so it wasn't as if most of these ill children had very much access to, they weren't going to school. They weren't able to eat candy or to get a hold of things. There was nobody passing around Playboys or like, you know, because everything had to go through security systems, basically. And since I was in the hematology oncology ward, there was a lot of worry about diseases getting in. Visitors had to be approved. Nobody could come in who had any sorts of illnesses, or they would put masks on people, things like that, to keep germs from getting in. And there was just a lot of protection of the children. And there were children like myself, not very many, but who didn't really get very many visitors. Because if a mother had other children, like what was she couldn't just, other children were very seldom in the hospital because of germs. Okay. My siblings never came. And I know that wasn't true of all the other families, but never once did any of my siblings come to the hospital. One of the beautiful things since I wrote the book and since it came out into the world is how many former members that I've had the opportunity to hear from, especially former members who knew me. I do have my birth name. And so there were many people who knew my parents even before I was born. And I've heard so many stories that have not only validated my experience, but have also opened my eyes to the diverse experiences that people had inside of this organization. I'm working on a book now called Prodigal Daughter. And it does, as I said earlier in this conversation, go more in depth into other people's stories as well, why people came to a cult, what people get out of a cult.
Okay.
And working on a screenplay that I finished too gave me an opportunity to see my mom as a central character, not only in my own life, but in the development of a cult that forbade women to speak in public. And yet my mother found ways to be a very strong voice. And so it's been really interesting, the things I've learned since the book came out.
I have to say that I'm relieved that there is another book because, okay, this book kind of goes from when you're about 6 or 7 up until about 17. You meet a guy at the 7-Eleven, go to a movie and dinner, and get excommunicated. And then, gosh, we're now 4 pages away from the end of the book when this is happening. And then you talk about getting shunned from the organization.
I'll add, David, though, that the shunning, the intent of the shunning when I was there was to punish me so that I would get in line. They didn't kick me out.
You weren't
they
kicked
stopped
out.
Speaking to me, which is a very painful experience to have everybody in your life stop speaking to you and treating you as if you're invisible. And it made it so uncomfortable that I needed to find a way out. But shunning and excommunicating are a little bit different from each other.
The funny thing is, the movie that you went to see, it was The Color Purple. It's not like you went and saw, I don't know, you know, like Ozzy ripping a bat's head off or something like that and came back raving.
I think The Color Purple is probably a very dangerous movie for
a young
girl.
Well, it would be in that situation of the mountain and the field because we're talking about a woman learning to be strong and stand up for herself. So I could imagine that would be a big no-no. But the thing is when you got home, you told your sister about the experience and it seems like her first act was to tell everybody else.
She probably told one person, although this has never been verified. Everybody talks.
Within a few hours. How many hours actually passed between you getting home and when you were told that you would be shunned? It was by the afternoon, I know you said.
Oh, yeah. Very few hours. And my sister never admitted to telling anyone. I don't know how else they would have known. It all happened very, very, very quickly. And to be fair, I think that I probably knew exactly what I was doing when I told my sister.
Yes, I was so tired
of hiding everything about myself. And I think I also wanted to trust my sister. And if she hadn't said anything, I think I would have felt there was reason to stay because we would have had solidarity. The fact that I also was just mesmerized and so enthralled with that film. Like, I really felt like it was life-altering. And I really, really wanted her to know that that existed. And yeah. I think it was a bit of a test.
And you were prepared for either outcome. So,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think so.
All right. Before we close this, there are a few things that I have to address. The cover art. I really want to know who's responsible for this. Just to describe it, we have the cover of the book as if it's been burned through, well, actually several times. It burned through to reveal the fifth chapter of 1 Thessalonians, and then that's burned through to reveal Matthew 19, and then that's burned through to reveal a berry, maybe this is the wild rose here. So I've described it. Now, if you could deconstruct this image or series of images, some of this stuff ties in directly with the book and is quoted in
there
other places.
There is such an interesting story here. I'm going to give you the brief version. First of all, there's more than one version of this cover. Authors do not get a choice of their cover, but they did show me that they were trying out. And one version of the cover was a book, probably the Bible, but you couldn't really tell. And there was all these flowers growing out of it. So like nature was growing out of the book. And all of the people I showed it to preferred that cover. They thought it was really, really enriching. And they thought the cover that was chosen was scary and like kind of absurd. What you didn't mention is the hole that it's kind of like growing out of honestly looks very vaginal. So it is very like a sort of dark space.
Well, I was thinking of flower, but let's ask Georgia O'Keeffe there.
Yes, it is a little of both. But the woman who created the cover, who I don't know, and she's given credit, she works for the publishing company and she is one of their book cover designers. And she actually physically burned the pages of the Bible.
Oh, wow.
And took real photos. That's actual photograph of burning pages of the Bible.
Oh.
And then she put them together in different forms to create like a womb space that she felt that something was growing out of the words.
Wow.
And it is such an unusual image. Again, I had no choice. No one ever even asked.
It also looks like a rose to me, actually,
yes.
The various petals coming out and the fact that there's layer upon layer and the choices that they made in which scripture to include burning away and which would be underneath that. Truly, it shows that I overthought this.
No, I don't think you overthought this. I really think that there are so many different layers.
It's incredible.
I think she did a phenomenal job.
Yeah, truly. I mentioned earlier there was sort of a metaphorical sense that I saw to so many of these things. One example would be pay attention to where you're stepping. This is illustrated, I think, a couple of times as far as you should not step over a log. You should step onto a log and then look and step off.
That's practical, good advice, application.
Well, yeah, watch out for snakes. You don't want to step into a thing and break your ankle and all that. I mean, that's very practical, literal use. But there's also such a much broader sense of, quote, knowing where you're about to step. So again, would there have been any of this that you were conscious of as it was happening? Or was it, again, 10, 15, 23 years later that you're going, whoa, I'm using that in my class. I'm looking before I'm leaping.
I did not understand any of what I learned while I was learning.
When you were saying, well, no, that's not, yeah.
All I do know is that I have had great fortune in nature because I continue to hike. And I do think that I learned some really wonderful skill sets to being in the great outdoors. But it took me a very long time to understand that this is, of course, how I managed to maneuver through my life without a support system. And I'll say I'm grateful. I wouldn't have chosen to be raised the way I was raised. But that being the case that I was raised that way, I am grateful that I at least learned skills and that it has enabled me to collect all sorts of wonderful humans along the way because I have been observant and I have had a degree of need. I have had to create a family of choice.
Gotcha. So the closing lines of the book, for me anyway, very much the overall lesson to be taken from this, perhaps. the lines that I latched onto, it's that we are made for recovery. Okay, and then it's a few lines later, but then you talk about the fact that you enjoy going on hikes still, and that you enjoy going off of the trail, off of the guided path, and getting to the point of being quote-unquote lost. But at this point, I don't panic. I stop, look around, and root myself into my surroundings, and breathe. If we could look at this as a fable, that's the moral at the end of it. There's a lot more in here that we could have spoken about, in all honesty.
Well, maybe our listeners should read the book, and they'll
understand more. Teaser, yes. And you'll, especially when the new book comes out, you'll understand why we go from Michelle being shunned to two pages covering I married, had four kids, went to college, and I'm wondering, okay, what happened between the time that you were shunned and you were accepted?
That is in the next book, yes.
You had a full ride at college, but there had to have been time between being away from the house and waiting for that semester to start. So there's...
Yeah, I was not housed.
But that's all coming in the next book.
It is all coming in the next book. And the publishers insisted on epilogue.
Good.
Which was wonderful to include. But they really insisted that readers wanted to have some idea that I survived okay. And I thought, well, I survived enough to write the book. That should be enough.
Oh, yeah. That should be a good indicator.
Exactly. But working on Prodigal Daughter really has taught me a lot about how many tools have been an asset to me throughout my life. I mean, it's not that I haven't had quite a few nightmares along the way, but I'm so grateful that I have been able to keep the tools that I learned in Forger.
Michelle Dowd, thank you so much for coming in and sharing more about Forger, Field Notes for Surviving a Family Cult. If the title doesn't get you to go pick it up alone, hopefully this conversation will have gotten a few people to go out and pick it up. Thank you so much for sharing more about this.
Thank you, David.
For this edition of KVCR, I've been speaking with Michelle Dowd, author of Forager, Field Notes for Surviving a Family Cult, a memoir. More on the book at michelledowd.org. So much more there as well. Michelle's on Instagram at michelledowdz. There's also mdowd.substack.com. The book's available in hardback, paperback, Kindle, and audio on Amazon and anywhere books are sold. Thanks again to Michelle Dowd. And here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Tony Lopez, and Shireen Awad. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR is composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, NPR One, and Google Play. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.